That's Gene Ammons on tenor sax with the Gene Ammons Quintet with Blue Ammons, lots of Ammons, from his 1960 album, Boss Tenor. Tommy Flanagan on piano, Doug Watkins on bass, Art Taylor on drums, and a well-known man named Ray Barreto on congas. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, January the 12th. Yes, it is. Can't get used to it. 2015. And Nigeria's military is calling for support from the world community of nations in the aftermath of the deadliest attack yet by the terrorist group Boko Haram 9 days ago. The appeal comes a day after more than 40 world leaders and dignitaries headed a march in Paris yesterday in solidarity with national mourning for 17 people killed in terrorist attacks last week. World reaction to the three-day spate of killings by three alleged Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists is in stark contrast, however, to the massacre of as many as 2,000 people in what is being called the single deadliest attack to date by Boko Haram in a town called Baga in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria. Dr. Chika Onyani, and you might have heard him here before a couple of times talking about the emerging terrorist situation in Nigeria. He's publisher and editor-in-chief of the African Sun-Times, and he joins us now to discuss the situation in Nigeria in the aftermath of the attack and the dichotomy in world reaction to these separate, though related, events. Dr. Onyani, Happy New Year, and thank you for joining us today.
Happy New Year to you, too. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much. Well, could you tell us what you know of the situation now in Nigeria?
Well, you rightly surmised the whole thing, the fact that the Boko Haram seems to be getting stronger and more daring and more vicious and more violent, and what happened in Baga is a horrible situation whereby more than, as you rightly said, 2,000 people were killed, and they were just going from house to house and slaughtering people, and the military hasn't been able to, despite the fact that they have been there in Borno State for such a long time. The military, in fact, the massacre of people was. From the aftermath, the mouth of Boko Haram running over a military base in Borno State, and so that is really the problem, and the fact that the Boko Haram has also started using some of the. Some of the students, I mean, some of those abducted girls, as suicide bombers, and so that is what is going on, and the fact that the West has, of course, ignored. The attacks in Nigeria, and especially when you hear the rationale on part of the U.S. as to why they are not selling, it's not that Nigeria wants America to hand them weapons. Nigeria wants to purchase the weapons from the U.S., and the U.S. has not been willing to sell the necessary weapons to fight Boko Haram, because Boko Haram is receiving weapons from the Arab states, and they are being paid for by people in the north, by some very wealthy northerners financing the weapons purchases by Boko Haram, and they are using sophisticated weapons, and now are able to, and they are getting help from other jihadists now.
What is the interest by the wealthy northerners in funding Boko Haram?
The question goes to the north-south dichotomy in Nigeria, in the sense that the north has always ruled Nigeria, and Nigeria has been independent for 54 years of independence from Britain since 1960. Out of that 54 years, the North has ruled the country 38 years. The present president of Nigeria is from the South, and is from the region called the South South, which is basically the region that produces the oil revenue of Nigeria, which makes up about 90% of Nigeria's income revenue, and most of this money has always gone to the north, but instead of using the money to develop the area, the people, the president, I mean, the heads of state, the military heads of state, they are very, very, very rich. They are very rich. We are still trying to recover the $5 billion that General Abacha stole. He just wrote a check for $2.5 billion and took it to the central bank, and they transfer the money into his account. That is the kind of, and we know, and the people have read, the richest man in Africa is from Nigeria, and he is from the north. So the status quo is what people, they are looking for. They are looking for power to devolve back to the north. This is why they have opposed the Jonathan administration, Goodluck Jonathan, so much, in the sense that they feel that especially after President Obasanjo, After his reign, and when he left in 2007, and that power should have come back to the north, which it did. But the thing was that the person who was selected, that is President Yar'Adua, he was sick when he ran for election, and they died in office. And the North said, Jonathan should not contest. Jonathan should not even be made. He was the vice president. They didn't want him to be acting president, and they didn't want him to be confirmed as president. When he was confirmed in 2011, when he decided to run, a lot of northern leaders opposed his running. So this is why his party, which contained a lot of northern governors, those governors left. Seven 7 of the governors left the party because of the fact that they wanted power to come back to the north. And Jonathan, of course, ran for election. And this time, they are also opposing him. Basically, that is the problem, that that Boko Haram is being used as a political tool to wrest power from the so-called South-South, which is not, I mean, after 54 years, the North has ruled for 38 years. The South-South, where Jonathan comes from, by next month, he would have, by April, he would have been in office for 5 years as a president. And,
but you know, Dr. Onyani, this is a very interesting dichotomy which continues now in 2015, the election year, because we still have that north-south dichotomy here, with the north being predominantly Muslim and the south predominantly Christian and traditional religions. Now, I'm following in the a paper, I think you might know it. It's called the African Sun-Times. I've been reading it. So I've been following your coverage of this pending election. And here again, we see the dichotomy being played out by Jonathan Goodluck Jonathan, the current president and incumbent, going up against General Muhammadu Buhari, a Muslim from the north. So, and now this attack occurs in the context of this push-pull. So do we have a connection here between this attack, this blisteringly devastating attack by Boko Haram? Is it meant in some way to shape the election?
Well, of course, the opposition has been seizing on the fact that Goodluck Jonathan has not been able to provide security to the people. People see what is being portrayed is Jonathan as a weak president, and you have to understand that Buhari, General Muhammadu Buhari, ruled Nigeria as a military man. He was head of state for almost 2 years before he was toppled in office and removed. And so they believe that as a military man, he might be able to bring especially coming from the north, that he might be able to bring the Boko Haram the attacks to an end. So that is what they are trying to sell to Nigerians, that Buhari will be able to provide security to Nigerians. But Nigerians also know that Buhari just last year also said that an attack on Boko Haram is an attack on the whole North, you know. And we have to understand, even though the North is predominantly Muslim, you have many states that are Christian. You have Plateau State. Benue State, you have Taraba State, you have Adamawa State, you have Gokki State. All those out of the 19 states, the 19 states in the north, you might have about 5 to 7 that are not Muslim. And so in terms of equation, you can see that there are many ways that Jonathan can win the election with a lot of people also in the north. But Buhari last time was able to win 12 states in the north, because you have to understand he has contested election three times already. And what Nigerians are not happy is he feels an entitlement that he must be president.
This call for help, this call for military help, is coming from the Nigeria military, not from President Jonathan, not from Buhari, but from the military. Is that significant?
Well, when the military calls for help, it's actually Jonathan calling for help. And
why isn't he articulating that? Why is it that the military is articulating that?
Well, the thing is that there is a lot of people who are not happy with the military. They feel the military has disappointed Nigerians and has been very weak and has not performed its duties. And if they compare that to Cameroon, which has put up a strong military to challenge and to fight off the Boko Haram, despite threats from the Boko Haram, Cameroon has been able to checkmate and to expel them back into Nigeria. Every time that Boko Haram has attacked, Cameroon has been able to counterattack and has killed many of Boko Haram members. Despite the fact that the military, no doubt in Nigeria, has improved a great deal from what it was from when they used to run away. But when you also see that Boko Haram was able to run over a military base, and you ask your question, to what extent has the military really improved if they are not able to hold off a so-called ragtag army, but which is now is no longer a ragtag army, is a well sophisticated army that is well armed, and it's a disgrace though to hear the military calling for. I mean, Africa's largest country in population, its military not being able to fight off how many thousands of Boko Haram members.
But in the meantime, Dr. Onyani, we have to see what the bottom line looks like, and the bottom line looks like in the middle of all of this. Internal unrest and political unrest. Boko Haram has consistently escalated its terror attacks, this one in Baga being the deadliest so far, with an estimated 2,000 and perhaps even more killed just in the last weekend. But they also have successfully established what they said they were going to do, which is to establish a caliphate. They're being supported by the wealthy people in the north. And it seems as if in the middle of all of this, they have achieved an objective. And the world, despite the fact that the world community of nations says they're concerned and they're helping providing strategic help and military help and advisors and whatever else they're saying, why is it that in the middle of all of this, Boko Haram, in effect, has achieved its objective, Baga being perhaps the last holdout town in the northern eastern region?
Well, actually, it might be questionable as to whether they have achieved their objective, because Borno State is a very big state. And even in Borno State, election is supposed to be held next month for the presidential election. It's not being nothing. No state in the Northeast is excluded from election being held. But as people have said, to what extent will the election be successful if it is not disrupted? If it is disrupted by Boko Haram, to what extent will those states be fairly counted as a voting bloc? And to that extent, you can say that really Boko Haram has not been, because there are some towns and some villages and all that they had captured before, and now the military recaptured them and expelled them. But when they commit this kind of very heinous violence, this killing, this vicious killing, and it is really very, I mean, the world notices, and is a way, compared to what happened in France, is a way of the Islamists bringing a great deal of attention to themselves to say, we are very powerful. We can strike anytime we want, and but in the final analysis, I believe that eventually, eventually Nigeria will be able to expel the Boko Haram. I believe that that it is going to happen in the near future.
Well, I mean, one wonders what is the body count supposed to be when that happens, because if 2,000 people killed, or perhaps even more, killed in one fell swoop, and we have a repeat of really vicious attacks in Nigeria, we have the abductions of young girls and men, we have these girls now, many of them being used as suicide bombers with these deadly bombs strapped to their bodies and detonated remotely. One wonders what the figure would be. But I want to ask you about your view of how the world has reacted, especially the Western nations that were supposed to be so involved in helping Nigeria with its Boko Haram problem, how those nations have reacted to the terrorist attacks in Paris, and how they have reacted to Boko Haram. What do you see?
Well, I see double standard. You know, that is what I see, and I see hypocrisy on the part of the U.S. itself, which has refused to sell the weapons that Nigeria has asked to buy. It's not to be given. They want to buy it and pay for it, but they want to attack helicopters, and the U.S. denied to sell these weapons because of the Human Rights Watch is accusing the Nigerian military of human rights abuses, against Boko Haram. To many Nigerians, they see hypocrisy on the part of the U.S., which can go to, when they send these drones, you see the drones killing many civilians. And so what is the difference when Nigerian military is operating and Boko Haram has immersed itself within the society? So one or two civilians or whatever are killed, and the U.S. bases its refusal and then condemns Nigeria for that. Nobody is condemning the U.S. for its attacks that kill civilians in different parts of the world. Nobody is doing that. So Nigeria had to stop the U.S. from training its military because of the way the U.S. Decided to just and even in terms of so-called help that the U.S. had promised to give Nigeria after the Chibok girls were abducted. You remember, U.S. said we are going to be helping to find where the girls are, and you get those things, and you say you don't want to share it with the country that you say you're helping, you know, because you believe the military is going to use it to violate the people's human rights. How are they going to be able to recover the girls? How are they going to fight Boko Haram if you have the facts and you don't want to share it with them? And Britain follows the U.S. now. It used to be the other way around. The U.S. would say, oh, we defer to Britain. But the U.S., Britain now follows U.S. in terms of policies in Africa. And, of course, France itself is immersed in its problem, but it is more concerned with Francophone countries than Nigeria. And then you have China, Russia. They are not. They are more interested in being neutral than really, because whichever way the wind blows is the way they will go.
I'm also looking, Dr. Onyani, at the racial aspect here. It's hard to ignore that we have almost 50 world leaders coming to Paris. Most of the 17 people killed are French. In Nigeria, we have 2,000 Africans killed. And there isn't in any way a proportionate response. It's hard to miss this racial aspect in this case.
Well, that is true, and is going to continue to be like that because, you know, the lives of Africans are not as valuable as that of the French citizens. That is basically the conclusion that people draw from what has happened in Paris. As you rightly said, 50 world leaders, although they are condemning the U.S. for Obama not appearing, or Kerry not appearing, Secretary of State not appearing, but 50 world leaders there, and 17 people killed, and over 2,000 killed here, and that doesn't include the suicide bombings that have been occurring on a daily basis now. So far as it's black on black crime, just like here, nobody pays too much attention, and it's African upon an African butchering other Africans. And the sad part of it is that the so-called Boko Haram that believes very much in Islam is killing other Muslims. Is what people cannot understand.
Dr. Chika Onyani, publisher and editor-in-chief of the African Sun-Times, I thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll continue keeping an eye on this issue. It is hard to dismiss. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Utris, for inviting me.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back to talk about the fighting spirit in Detroit, even though there are fewer fighters.
Listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Sam Thurman of A Just Cause Coast to Coast. Join me along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez right here on Progressive Radio Network, that's PRN.FM, each Sunday morning from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time for A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice.
Everyone, my name is Beatty Cohan. I want to welcome you to my new Ask Beatty show. I am a psychotherapist, a sex therapist, an author, speaker, columnist, and national radio and television expert guest. We're going to be talking about love, relationships, and sex. We're also going to be discussing mental health issues that we're hearing about in the media. And you will also have an opportunity to call me and ask me about any personal problems that you may be experiencing. So join me on the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. I'll talk to you then.
I'm Glenn Ford.
And I'm Nellie Bailey.
Every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we bring you Black Agenda Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's produced by the team at BlackAgendaReport.com, the cutting-edge publication for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left.
So check out our view of the world and explore our rich archives on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward.
And we hope you're coming with us.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. And the new year, still fresh enough, brings with it a new fighting spirit in beleaguered Detroit, says activist Elena Herrada, a member of the Detroit School Board and member of Detroiters still resisting emergency management. Elena provides for us today an overview of where the battle lines are being drawn, even though, she says, grassroots organizations still in the fight have been whittled down to just a hardy few. Thank you, Elena, for being with us.
Thank you.
How are you doing? Happy New Year and all of that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, if happy means still being in the fight, then yes, I'm very happy. So we have major battles in front of us. But as our elders in the battle say, no matter what happens, you keep fighting. And if that's the measure, then we're doing fine.
So what are the battle lines being drawn about?
This week, and I'll speak from the perspective of an elected school board member in Detroit, because this week we're about to face the appointment of a new, yet another emergency manager over Detroit Public Schools. And the reason that's important, and I hope that our listeners are keeping up with the Detroit bankruptcy and with the voter nullification through the emergency manager law that was actually repealed by the voters, but imposed anyway. And the main reason we needed emergency managers in Detroit, from the perspective of the bankers, was so that they could file bankruptcy, because the city of Detroit did not file bankruptcy. The bankruptcy law firm Jones Day did. And that's a whole lot of context that people are going to have to bear with me for. But the reason it's important about the emergency manager being appointed in Detroit Public Schools again this week is the following. Try to stay with me on this. The Governor Snyder in bankruptcy court, which I witnessed, told Judge Rhodes, the bankruptcy judge, upon questioning that Detroit voters are not stripped of our voting rights under Public Act 436, the emergency manager law, because it has a beginning and an end of 18 months. And therefore, after 18 months, the emergency manager would be removed and governance would be restored, which is what they did to the city. But Detroit Public Schools, we had already been under emergency manager for almost 5 years. And they changed the law to 436, which would have applied to us the same way as it did to the rest of the city. And when we went to court to vote out the emergency manager, according to our rights as elected officials, we were told by the judge in court that that 18-month period only applied to that emergency manager and that a new one could be named after 17 months and 29 days for as long as the governor would like to do that. So the emergency manager, it will be appointed again, but it's in direct conflict with what Governor Snyder told to the bankruptcy judge in his response about voters being stripped of our voting rights in Detroit and every other black city in the state of Michigan. So that's important context. I don't know if anybody will follow it, but when I was watching Selma last week, I was watching the movie, and the Voting Rights Act was in there. I thought the people who in Detroit have been completely stripped of our voting rights under the emergency manager law, and they've even created a separate and unequal school district, the Educational Achievement Authority, all because they were able to do this without any interference from elected officials. So I know that's a long explanation, but that's where we are.
That is a very cogent one, but keep going.
Well, Wednesday is the day that we hear that they're going to name a new emergency manager to Detroit Public Schools. Now, this is what's also very important. The emergency manager, since taking over Detroit, initially was brought in as an emergency financial manager. But since that time, they have tripled our debt and closed more than half of our schools. They've given away 15 schools to this Jim Crow Educational Achievement Authority, which we have no control of, but full financial responsibility for. Our children in the last, it only has existed now, this is its second year of existence, our children all lost ground in every category. They were already taking these kids and saying that they were failing. They took failing schools and put them into the EAA, which is the same as the recovery district in New Orleans, portfolio district it is there. And they took our children and failed them worse than they had been, but now they're going to try to expand it under this new emergency management. So the mayor of Detroit, Duggan, is in with Snyder to bring about what's called a portfolio district, which is what they've done to New Orleans. They want to bring that here. So that's what they're going to announce this week. They're going to announce a new emergency manager in direct violation of even their bogus law, and to put it under the extremely separate and unequal portfolio district. So that's what they're bringing to Detroit.
Why is it called a portfolio district?
Like, as in hedge funds, as in investors. Basically, it's all private charters. It'll be all private charters, just like they did in New Orleans.
Well, we know that in New Orleans, there is no public school system left. It is entirely charted up, as I used to say. The system of education is in private hands completely in the city of New Orleans. And this is now the move being made after the bankruptcy proceedings have been declared, and the judge has approved the bankruptcy exit plan by the then appointed emergency manager. Now comes the new wave of activities to further privatize Detroit, and the school system is a prime target.
Right. As long as it's only black children, it'll be allowed to happen. I want to also make mention of the fact that since we've been under emergency manager under the city of Detroit and Detroit Public Schools, and we have a white mayor who was not on the ballot, who was written in and given money by the corporations to the extent that there was so much money put into this mayoral campaign by the corporations that came here and would benefit from having no governance, such as Dan Gilbert from Quicken Loans, Mike Ilitch, who's now going to get a brand new stadium at our expense. Now, we're supposed to be bankrupt, but we're building a new stadium for a billionaire who will not have to pay any taxes, and the taxes that he's going to capture were headed for education funds. They're taking the tax captures of education money and giving it to a billionaire to build him a new hockey arena. That's Mike Ilitch, who owns the Red Wings, who owns, they own everything, but it's just not enough. They're taking from the poorest people and giving money to the richest people, and that's what Governor Snyder and Mayor Duggan are doing in Detroit. While the poorest people are taxed, the new people coming in are getting tax abatements. There's incredible inequality of opportunity in Detroit, all these new jobs that are coming. You see all the good jobs in Detroit, the construction jobs, all of the high-paying jobs. You see all white people in those jobs. There was a time in Detroit when those work sites would have been shut down, but not now, because the NAACP, who would have done that, is now headed up by Wendell Anthony, who urged his congregation and urged pensioners to take the plan of adjustment, to take the cuts. Wendell Anthony has been completely silent on these terrible, terrible injustices in the schools and is now appointed to a coalition to help them take over the schools. So all the voices that would have been standing up with us, the ACLU, has a part in the coalition to take over the schools, all of those voices, and you know why? Because they got foundation money, and most of it is from Excellent School of Detroit, which is Skillman money. All of them are getting money in exchange for their silence. And in the meantime, the majority of the people in Detroit who are extremely poor will get only more poor unless we stop them.
And what are you going to be doing to stop them?
Well, there's all kinds of plans in the works, and there's many, many organizations, grassroots people. As you know, there is a moratorium now. There's Detroit is resisting emergency management. There's always, of course, welfare rights organization. Many organizations who are coming together to fight the water shutoffs, to fight the foreclosures. There's Detroit Eviction Defense. There's all kinds of people that are busier now more than ever and than we've been in years and years and years, gathering to fight back against these corporate crimes against our community.
So in a way, this whittling down has had the unintended benefit of identifying the true grassroots people who are still in the fight.
That's really very true. That's very true. And it also has the sort of sharpened edge of really laying bare the incredible racism of the structure that we're living in now. It really completely lays it bare, because the opportunities are almost all going to white people. And also, there's historic wealth and there's historic poverty. And where did that come from? It came from historic inequality. It came from slavery. It came from all kinds of inequalities that existed, but were, you know, everybody was sort of living side by side for the longest time. But when you start to chip away at the basic things that people had, pensions and homes and jobs and maybe the possibility of going to college, then only people that had a little bit of a cushion can survive that. And who's that? That's white people. And why is that? Why is that? It becomes more and more clear. Why is that? Because white people had money. Because they have certain privilege. Why did they have money? Where did they get money from when other people didn't have money? It begs the question that is going to have to be answered. And as long as these opportunities continue to divide, and it's unbelievable how much inequality has come to Detroit, in a city that was once just really a promised land for anybody willing to work. Now we have all these speculators, all these investors who are coming here like vultures. It's absolute vultures coming in, buying up homes that we're facing another, did I hear 60,000? 60,000 was the number, foreclosures in the coming year. That's an incredible number of people to render homeless. And their homes are on auction on the Internet, so some people don't even know that until the deputies get to their house. So there's been people getting shot when they tried to take over a home that they said that they bought. People shooting people that were in the house. There's been people have died over these Internet auctions of homes here. Everybody thinks you can just walk in here and buy a beautiful house online, sight unseen, and, you know, just live a good life in Detroit. Like, nobody was here. Like, nobody was in that house. It's incredible the sort of narrative around Detroit that you see in the New York Times or in the Detroit News and Free Press, that, you know, it's just a great place to come. It's safe to come back, white folks. There's no black people downtown. There's nobody else downtown. It's, you know, the sort of narrative is, you know, all these places are just wide open. It's wide open. So everybody can just come here and plunk down your few bucks and get a really nice house and open up a business. You'll get a grant from the city to open up a business. And, you know, it's just here for the taking. But we've been here all this time. And we're just watching as people come here and buy up buildings that no one else could ever have afforded, start businesses that no one would ever been able to do, start businesses. It's just incredibly, incredibly, it's outrageous what you see in Detroit now. It's outrageous.
Well, I'll be asking you to make a return visit with us, Elena, because I really want to get into this business of the schools, reason okay. being that we've discussed before that what is happening in Detroit is really a template for what is to happen elsewhere. And what has happened already in other parts of Michigan, Detroit being, in a sense, a jewel in the crown of this kind of bizarre and perverted transformation. So we would ask you to come back again and talk with us about the school system particularly. But I just want to get an overview from you about where the fight on the schools issue is going to go.
That's a very good question, because as long as this is the problem in Michigan, as long as it's only affecting black people, it's okay with everybody else. So if they take one district, Educational Achievement Authority, which was supposed to be a statewide district, then people will go in there.
And, kind of breaking up a little bit.
Oh, sorry, can you hear me? Okay. Yes. Only the poorest children will go into the Educational Achievement Authority. Then you have the Excellent School of Detroit creating these sort of boutique schools in certain neighborhoods where white people will want to put their children. And they'll be safe there, and they'll feel comfortable, and they'll have small classroom sizes, and all the things that they would have had in a wealthy suburb. So it's a way of taking white privilege and implanting it into certain areas and just completely othering everybody else. And that, if that isn't fought in the same way that the original fights were fought, then you know, that I have complete faith that we're going to prevail. I was here when we desegregated Detroit public schools, and that caused white flight. And the important issue of the schools, if children are not together, then there's going to be continued racial imbalance, racial injustice. If they segregate the schools, even by class, there's going to be a huge number of people that are just left out in Detroit. And what they're going to try to do with them is move them to the first and second ring suburbs that are all run down now, and sort of flip the narrative on white flight so that it would be white return and black push out. So if we don't fight school segregation, if we don't fight school segregation, we're going to lose the whole battle. And that's where I'm completely confident that fight is going to, that will be the centerpiece of the struggle.
Thanks, Elena, for being with us today. Always insightful talking with you, and always encouraging, because, you know, when we hear your voice and we hear, of course, the huge mountain you're trying to tackle here, we also hear of a spirit that is not about giving up. You don't give up. And
remember,
that is quite
also
inspiring.
That we've done it before. Please keep in mind that we've done it before. That it wasn't always like this. There wasn't always equality. There wasn't always paradise. We didn't have paradise. But we know how to fight, and we've done it before. We've been here before. And all we have to do is dig deep and call upon our own historic roots of struggle. And I hope that everyone will be encouraged. And keep an eye on Detroit, because we are not falling.
Thank you, Elena. Thanks so much for being with us. Elena
Errada, thank you.
Of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. They should put a little parenthesis saying, still resisting emergency management.
All right. Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye. Well, as we come to the end of the program today, I must say how wonderful it was to have been in fellowship, which is really what it was. It was a spirit of fellowship on Friday past at Convent Avenue Baptist Church in Harlem. We gathered to do our duty, which was to pay tribute and honor to the master teacher, Dr. John Henry Clark. We had a wonderful showing, a wonderful gathering, and I was just bowled over by the fact that listeners came from as far away as Dallas, Texas, and Chicago. And I want to thank you for that. I was hoping somehow that we would have been able to meet the next day for breakfast or something. And by the time I looked around, they were gone. So I want to thank you so much, Mamadou, and thank you so much, Henry, for being with us. It was such an inspiration to see you there, but it was an inspiration to see everyone there. And we had a great time just saying thank you to Dr. Clark. And that was the whole purpose of the evening, saying thank you. And I want to thank everyone for the wonderful turnout that we had and the great spirit that you brought into that sanctuary of gratitude and of respect and of honor to such an extraordinary man. And it is the start of his centennial year, and there will be events staged all across the country to revitalize and revive his work, and not just his work, but the work of people like Dr. Clark, other scholars who did their life's work very quietly, but they did it. They hunkered down and produced work, and work that withstands the test of time. And that you can't say enough thank you for. So in a way, through Dr. Clark, we see the service that scholars, our scholars, have made in retrieving these missing pages of our history and providing us a reference point for where we ought to be going and who we ought to be as a people. So I for that very much. I enjoyed it. And you will be hearing something soon about another event, perhaps in a couple more months. So that brings us to the end of the program. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. I hope this program opened our eyes to something new to think about, the Boko Haram attack in Nigeria and how it contrasts with the way the attack in Paris is being treated. And it's a sad commentary, but it is important to note, because this is the world we're living in. And, of course, the unfolding drama in Detroit, where we were very clear from the beginning that it is meant to be a template for many other so-called urban areas. Coming up next, Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Keep it right here. Bye-bye.